Hey, everybody, quick announcement before the show starts. If you're around on Sunday, July 7th, we're having our first independent labor assembly sponsored by the Independent Labor Club of New York. It's going to be at Talon Bar, 220 Wyckoff Avenue in Brooklyn, New York, Sunday, July 7th at 3 p.m. We're having an excellent guest, Gregory A. Butler, retired carpenter and author of Disunited Brotherhoods, Race, Racketeering, and the Fall of the New York Construction Unions. He and I are going to be talking about why the left has lost the working class. And of course, because this is an ILC event and our first really big public event, we're going to be discussing ways that that could be remedied. So again, Talon Bar, Sunday, July 7th, 3 p.m. It'll basically be a free live podcast recording. So if you're in the area and you're free, do come out, hang out, say hello, and we hope to see you there. We fucking sorted it, dude. With our big, giant, genius brains, we managed to be able to podcast.
I think the clock needed to strike 10 a.m. before I could figure out that very obvious audio issue.
Okay, wow. I got my nice little headphones on. I got it like an hour and 10 minutes. I'm sorry, guys, I can't stay much longer. I have to run to this event.
Jacob, oh, what's the event?
I got to see Leah Ippi, this philosopher, talk about why socialism is moral.
Moral.
Leah right. Ippi. Oh.
Leah Ippi, Albanian philosopher, teaches in London.
Okay.
And very cool.
She wrote a book called Free about the failure of real socialism and the failure of real capitalism.
Wow.
Interesting.
Yeah. Free was Abby Hoffman's first pseudonym.
There you go.
So Leah Ippi, keeping the Ippi tradition alive.
Yeah. Should do an event at the Ippi Museum downtown. Is that still around?
No, it is not.
I remember that place.
Didn't we, Jacob, you and I meet with a bunch of lawyers in the basement of that place when we were in trouble?
I'm pretty sure we did, yes. Yeah. Oh, we did! We did! Wait, did we get our... Is that where we did our class action?
Yeah, I think so. I think we sat down with, like, National Lawyers Guild
people.
Tommy lawyer types.
Did you get nice and baked down there?
Big law. We fought the law.
We fought the law and we won. We are here. It's the Antifada. This is a Sean and Andy episode. We're here with an old friend, returning champion, Jacob Blumenfeld. What's up, Jacob?
How you guys doing? Great to be back. My favorite show in the world.
Favorite show in the world. That's pretty good. We're doing pretty good, citizen. How's life out there in Alemania?
Oh, Germany. Great. Germany is just a fantastically free country with a strong economy and a strong civil society, strong nation, strong blood.
Oh,
strong
boy.
It's a strong.
Did you say strong blood and strong soil or just the blood?
No, just the blood. The soil's ruined.
Okay.
Poisoned by the blood.
You guys are, we're not here to talk about the various different, I was about to go off on like the epic decline of, German economy and German political power in Europe over the last couple of years. But we're not here to talk about that today. We're not here to talk about the Gaza war. We're here to talk about something far more heartening, which is climate change. You
remember that? It didn't stop.
It didn't stop. It's
still changing.
Still changing after all these years. Last we left you, and I think it's been a few years since you've been on, we were talking about the value form. We were talking about critical theory. We were talking maybe about your philosophy of property work that you were on from like Aristotle forward. Do you remember any of this?
No.
Since then, you've done a bit of a heel turn. Yeah. Is it fair to say you've done a heel turn and become like a climate ethicist, like a communist climate ethicist, or like a climate critical theorist,
environmental economist, maybe?
Yeah,
I'm just still thinking about the world and what's wrong with the world that we live in, and I thought about property for a while as a kind of social form in which we live, in which we're trapped, and how that makes our world wrong. And now I'm just thinking about the environment and our ecological conditions of existence and what's wrong with that. Also as a social form, though, not as just a purely kind of natural condition, but what makes it wrong socially. So I'm still just looking at the world, wondering about what's happening and trying to live up to the reality that we're faced with. I think that's just the challenge we have.
That's the human challenge, right?
Yeah, you can say that.
Or is it the class challenge?
Yeah. I mean, to become human, I think, is a hard thing in these days, right? For all of us.
It's hard to be human.
It's hard to be human.
You know the Mekon song, "It's Hard to Be Human"?
Sing it.
It begins, "I made a mistake when I looked into the mirror. Cromwell was right behind me in the driving rain." So a lot of your work, recent work with Managing Decline that came out and your piece on Malm and the climate and critical theory, ponders this conception of climate Mao, right? Which is from the Climate Leviathan book that you have interfaced with a lot. This breeds perhaps the possibility, the speculative possibility of a climate Cromwell.
There could be a climate Cromwell.
A glorious restoration of actually existing socialism, perhaps. You're going real out in left field here.
just starting right away with climate Cromwell.
Andy's been awake for like 15 minutes. You are like in the middle of the absolute catastrophe that is German society right now, and we're just going for it, man.
It's just utter everywhere I look, I see decline. I don't want to, but I just see it. I see just the line goes down.
And yet we have to manage it, right? Which is the piece which is out in Cured Quail 4, which all of us will be getting because these three are friends of the show. Is it three?
Three.
I'm jumping ahead. Cured Quail 3, which is coming out shortly. It's called Managed Decline. Tell us a little bit about what it is that you were trying to do with this piece. It kind of it's a continuation of the other piece that you wrote several years back. So talk about both of the pieces and your work on the climate.
Yeah, so I wrote this piece called Climate Barbarism, I think published in 2022, but started thinking about it, you know, 2018, 19, when there was a climate wave or movement in Germany, in Europe especially, with Fridays for Future. And there was just a year of massive kind of activism and awareness with the IPCC report that year whole wave of shutdowns at coal plants, of big climate groups like Ende Gelände in Germany. And it was just everywhere, right? And people thought that 2018, 2019, this is the year when climate becomes the main issue. You also had a kind of a wave of new critical and Marxist thinking on climate change, trying to think of climate from a critical perspective as part of or climate is not just caused by human beings lighting fires and burning coal randomly or just as a attribute of human beings, but as a result of a particular class, a class project to exploit labor as efficiently as possible. And the best means to do that is to use fossil fuels, to use oil, to use coal, because it's transportable, because it can be taken to cities, because it's not dependent on location, it's not dependent on the time of day. It's easier to shut down strikes to move people away from it. So fossil fuels is a class project, and how is climate change, which is the changing of our ecological and metabolic conditions of reproduction for the planet, how is that a result of this class project, basically? And I thought about that research and that this movement together, and inspired also by Andreas Malm, by Joel Wainwright, and Jeff Mann, and some other writers on eco-Marxism and eco-socialism. I was wondering if they were a bit too optimistic.
I see. You were reading Fossil Capital and being like, this guy doesn't know how true bad it is.
This book, The Deluge, you reference, was that the one that was properly not optimistic? That's the one that you think kind of nails it?
The Deluge came out last year or 2 years ago, and that one really nails it. I think it really shows kind of the reality of the scale of the catastrophe. I think it's just really hard for us to imagine the scale of what's happening. It's just a background condition, right? And you can't imagine the background. You can't really think about the background. That's just the background. So to grasp it, to make it the foreground, is just really difficult. You know, there's this thinker from the 20th century that I really like called Günter Anders. I have a paper on him coming out next month in Brooklyn Rail. And he tried to think about human beings' destructive capacity through the production of the atom bomb. And he said, we don't have the ability to imagine what we're actually doing. Previously, people couldn't imagine like what they want to do. They couldn't imagine like a utopia. Nowadays, he says, it's reversed. Nowadays, we can't imagine what we're actually doing. The consequences of our actual actions is the hard thing to grapple with, to incorporate that in our moral thinking.
And the difference, of course, between nuclear weapons and, say, a coal power plant, or the electrification through fossil fuels of society, is that the atom bomb is explicitly an intent, a destructive device. But what Malm grapples with, who I've read, but some of the others I haven't, so you grapple with as well, is that this background condition is actually like the basis for like the material substratum of an entire mode of production, whose capacities we recreate day in and day out, but of course, as we know, is under the control of nobody. So a nuclear weapon is there to blow up the world. A coal power plant there is to make life possible, or at least modern life possible.
Or a nuclear power plant.
A nuclear power plant. There you go. Germany was really good at shutting all those down, right?
I mean, here's the thing. Fossil fuels help power our society, right? They help. They allow us to do things. They allow us to electrify, electrify hospitals, schools, to produce the goods we need to survive. No one's building or you know, the project of extracting hydrocarbons and refining them into plastics. It was not intended to manipulate the carbon cycle, to manipulate the nitrogen, to manipulate the atmosphere so that we are poisoned. That was not the goal. That was an unintended consequence, although we've now known it for a long time. The question is, how do you grab it? I mean, how do you direct it in a way that's not lethal? And that's a very difficult thing to do. And because you're right, it's the result of millions of choices. It's the result of investment decisions, of state planning, and of markets at such a scale that it makes individual responsibility kind of, shudder in the front of it. So you just retreat to your individual consumer choices, or you offload it onto the state. Right. So there's no in between power. There's just the individual or there's a state, and they're the ones that can solve it. Anything like a collective power, like a collective social power, like unions or any other class project, kind of just falls away. And I was trying to think about, okay, maybe there's something in between the individual and the state that has the power to put pressure and challenge our fossil fuel society. That was kind of the first essay, Climate Barbarism. The hypothesis there was that even if people start recognizing climate change and stop denying it, that doesn't necessarily mean a progressive emancipatory solution. That could actually lead to very reactionary and regressive policies. So we recognize climate change as a society or as a region or as a state, and close our borders to defend our resources or make a green welfare, special economic zone or something surrounded by militarized border regimes. Or we scapegoat those who are overusing resources to those who are racialized minorities. So I think the recognition of climate change as a fact is not sufficient to create a kind of vision of what you want a better world to be. So if that's the case, then what do you need?
Well, we're in the midst of a green transition here in the United States, and I'm at ground zero of it. We're working for a big public utility here in New York City, and we're building a green energy hub. So we're fucking doing it, man. Out there every day doing the green transition. Problem with the green transition, of course, is that we're all working and we're all making money on this job. Many of us are commuting all the way from Pennsylvania, driving in their gas-powered
automobiles in, and the actual production of this green energy hub, of course, is like massively fossil fuels are massively implicated in it, right? From the use of the excavators to the other large machines, to the concrete that's being created in this. And so we're seeing right now in the trades, especially in New York, which the state of New York was able to grab a lot of this funding because it's a very powerful state, and kind of direct it towards our needs for the capital to go into this transition, and also the needs of labor, you know, sitting at the table, business unions sitting at the table there. But like, everybody kind of recognizes that that's insufficient. But that's also like all that it seems like we're capable of doing. Like, the leading left edge of the green capitalist transition, as we know, is horribly inadequate to the task at hand. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of talk, and you talk about this in Climate Barbarism, of trying to figure out a way in which labor can be included in this. The way that labor has been included in the United States, and probably in Germany and many other places with like some semblance of social democracy or labor, organized labor sitting at the table, is to ensure that the jobs that go in are green, you know, or I'm sorry, the green jobs that go in are union and well paid. And that's all well and good. But there's, of course, no talk about changing the actual relations of production behind that, or understanding it as like a larger holistic project of not just the state, not just society, but humanity grappling with the enormity of this problem and consciously trying to plan its way out of it.
Exactly. I think that last thing you said is key, right? What does it mean to consciously plan our way out of it and not let it just kind of unconsciously develop in a very destructive transition? I think what you said is really interesting. I think there is a transition happening. Maybe we're not there at the point yet in which it's visible. But you could tell there's just so much more investment in renewables in U.S. and Europe and China, India. It hasn't really made a dent yet in the fossil in the energy mix. There's still tons of coal, gas, and oil, but renewables are coming, and you know they're getting the, you know, renewables are taking up higher and higher percentage in different countries. So I think there is a transition happening. The question is, it might take, you know, not 5 or 10 years, but 50 years. And I think what this transition is kind of a reorganization of labor, right? Mm. It's a moving around of labor to redevelop our cities and our environments by moving around technology, moving around different sources, and reshifting what production is. And I think that needs to be planned consciously.
Mm. And, so you're saying it's something of a great reset happening.
You're gonna get me fired.
Is that like a banned word in
or,
German?
Or get you hired at the
or get me hired
yeah. for Deutschland, you know, political yeah. institute for political economy yeah. or something.
Yeah. I mean this is just okay, just one more paradox. So eco-Marxists have been saying for a long time that there's no such thing, that green capitalism is impossible. I think that's a debatable proposition. Hmm. Right. So people say you can't have a capitalism that has like clean energy inputs or something because it'll undermine its own sources because it externalizes pollution or externalizes. Mm. I mean, I think it's debatable whether or not it can. Can it be profitable? I mean, it doesn't have to be profitable.
Right.
Like, you could have a stagnant capitalism for 100 years. It's still capitalism.
You could also have a capitalist state taking up a lot of the
exactly
the production and the maintenance of this, and having it almost as like a, not truly, but almost as a free good for capital.
Exactly. You could have states really be in the background there. Yeah.
So something you say early on in the essay, which I think is well put, is that I think for a long time we tried to think about this issue as a consumption problem of like, people are driving too much, they're buying big cars, they're eating too much beef or whatever. But you argue that fossil fuels are used irrespectively of what consumers want because production is not ruled by our needs but profitability. And the way to produce as much surplus value as possible has since the 19th century been through the combustion of fossil fuels, not because it has more surplus value in it, but because it allows for the most efficient exploitation of labor power. So to confront this contradiction, there's a reset in how labor power will be exploited. Mm. What do you think that would look like?
Well, the question is, what will it look like if we let the market and the state take control of it, or what it would look like if there's a conscious conscious planning or organization of class power to direct it. I think those are two different questions. Mm-hmm. I think it'll look, I think the switching out of different energy inputs, the reshaping of, or the electrification of cities, it might be done under very neoliberal conditions, right? It might require large state subsidies to make it still profitable, right? And then once cheap energies get, or once renewable energies get cheap enough, like what's happening with solar power, it might also be a problem, because then there's not a high enough return on investment for capitalists to really want it anymore. So there's always has to be some kind of state in the background directing this transition project. It doesn't necessarily mean it'll be in the benefit of those who produce it, but it can be, right? Because there's such power there to direct this transition, right?
Yeah.
Go on.
No, I was going to say, especially if you think about the arguments that Mal makes in Fossil Capital, which I'm most familiar with, right? Which is that water power, which is part of the initial industrial revolution, consolidates industry in very specific geographical regions, right? Where water can be exploited to turn mills, which can then be used to exploit labor power. Fossil fuels come in, as you said earlier, as a great way to like disperse production and allow capital to play laborers off one another and to break up whatever residual power of labor exists in that region. With these giant new complexes, with these wind farms that me and my people are building out east, you have like reconcentration and like a refixing of energy potential in certain geographical areas, certainly in the United States, without yet like the high tension power lines you would need to run that out all over the place. So a lot of the battle, it feels like, in the United States is over different states of the union, of the 50 states, attempting to like grab a hold of this new potential, this new concentrated energy producing potential, and wield it basically as like a developmental scheme within this new transition. So I wonder if maybe like that reconsolidation of the energy network will play out, will be part of this transition out of neoliberalism and into something else, right?
Yeah.
Combined with all the other sort of tendencies that we're seeing arise.
I mean, you have like, you know, people talking about industrial policy now, or kinds of economic coordination. You have a kind of a general openness to directing investment in different ways, right? Because people realize there has to be some kind of coordination if you want to decarbonize society. It won't just happen automatically. I mean, fossil fuel companies are going to fight to their death.
Oh yeah.
To keep the assets that they have in the ground. That's trillions of dollars, trillions of euros in the ground. There's no way they're going to just say okay. So they're going to hold that to the end. And if that actually gets dug up and burned, I mean, that'll be multiple degrees of heat.
Yeah.
Which will just have cascading crises of land, air, and water for our habitability. So why would they give that up? I mean, would they burn it, or wouldn't they? You know, would they play that card? Or they force the state to pay them out. Massive, massive payouts, right?
To pension them off like Mao did with the landlords, right?
Yeah, I mean, think about like imagine an analogy to abolition of slavery, in which the state pays slave owners for emancipation. So we're gonna pay the slave owners as compensation for emancipation. I mean, that's one possibility, right? So my argument in the second paper, Managing Decline, is that this process of the decline of a fossil fuel society has to be kind of coordinated, managed, right? It has to be managed. So it does so in a way that's directed for the welfare of human beings and not for the benefit of a few, and doesn't really care about the rest of the planet.
So why can't we have something like a climate Gerard Winstanley, a more anarchist approach where, you know, I've got like some friends in Earth First, for example, which is still a pretty big thing in the anarchist movement in the U.S. I know there's like similar things in Europe. Groups are fighting the construction of highways and airports and that sort of thing. Why do you think the sort of anarchist dispersed eco-sabotage approach can't work?
I mean, yeah, why isn't there a... Where's our climate blankie? Climate Bakunin. Where is he?
I think you allude toward climate Proudhon in the piece, which is eco-fascism.
I mean, the thing is, like, I think it's part of a struggle, but I just wouldn't say it can't be the only part. So that would be my answer. And the reason why it can't be the only part is because this is a problem that transcends locality, transcends even the nation state, and that the scale of transitioning energy, the transitioning of or the electrification of a society, cannot just be accomplished by a collective, right? If you want to reshape the design of a city, you can have collectives involved in that process, right? But how would you do that on such a massive scale? That's the problem for me. I think the scale of the climate crisis really forces a thinking on that scale, adequate to the level of the planet. So I think it's good to think about our planetary metabolism, our planetary vision, right? What a world commune, not just a local commune, and use that as a way for rethinking what any local project would be like in the, you know, embedded in a larger international or global vision, because the atmosphere doesn't care about, you know, a couple small projects, right? It cares about something that can really shift on a massive level. So it somehow has to be part of that larger process and not isolated on its own.
There's something about the tenor of this crisis, and we keep touching on it, right? It's a background noise. It's so large in scale that it's impossible for individuals to get their head around. The necessary transitions are such that, like, we seem as a species to be incapable of grasping that. There's a way in which we are, all of us, billions of us, embarking on maybe the greatest human adventure since the great population bottleneck, like 100,000 years ago, where there was like, what, 10,000 human beings left. This need, this necessity for us to think on this planetary scale, if we can be optimistic for a moment, really does, in a very visceral and material sense, change the entire scope of politics. So if there's hope coming out of this, it's that. And you isolate planetary and anti-planetary solutions to this crisis, right? Ones that are based on like a world commune or some sort of world body which is able to grasp hold of this problem and collectively solve it, versus what we have now, which is a collection of competing nation states and national capitals, which will go to the grave fighting one another based not on their necessarily on their greed, but on the incentives and the structures that the society produces. There's a way in which thinking planetarily now is absolutely necessary. Maybe that it wasn't even so in the 19th century. It's not a utopia. It's not a utopian goal. It's not positing a sort of utopian socialist coming together of humanity. It is instead posits the absolute necessity of human unity, which would necessitate, of course, you know, the overthrow of that which divides us and fractures us. So I don't know if you guys are down to go on this adventure with me. I'm too afraid to read that Deluge book. You know, I don't even want to know how bad it's going to get. I'm trying to think like optimistically and with hope about this, which you allude to in the piece too, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think why I find it still compelling to think about these questions is that it really opens up a new possibility for the future, for rethinking how we live together and on a planetary level, right? And our relationship with each other and our relationship with the nature. So this gives human beings, you know, the chance to reorganize our metabolism with nature and each other. And could be done in ways that are incredibly harmful and toxic and dangerous and chauvinist and xenophobic. It can also be done in ways that are creative and, you know, contribute to human flourishing. Aesthetic. I mean, there could be new ways of experiencing nature, right? Yeah. That we don't even know about, because we are divided into these little cells that just kind of reproduce with fossil fuel inputs. I think it's like a chance that's possible, right? And climate change gives us this opportunity, kind of horrifically.
Yeah.
Right. The face of the catastrophe forces a choice on the scale of the planet. And the problem here is that you could say, okay, well, if we're all just human beings, then we're just all in this together. But obviously we're not, right?
Right.
Right. Climate change is unevenly distributed, and it's going to require power.
This maybe leads to a quote that you sort of framed the article around from Adorno. He says, "What can oppose the decline of the West is not a resurrected culture, but the utopia that is silently contained in the image of its decline." What kind of image are you thinking of here if we're talking about the increasing heat of the Atlantic Ocean or the higher rates of natural catastrophe?
Yeah, it's a good challenge to say, like, how dare you be utopian, right, at a time like this? This is what we need is anti-utopianism. We need realism. We need thinking about the reality of the crisis, the reality of the catastrophe. I mean, like, that's a fair position to take right now. But I think there are different kinds of utopianism, right? And I think I'm very partial to Otto Neurath. Otto Neurath's what he called scientific utopianism. Otto Neurath was a socialist philosopher, mathematician, geographer, planner in Germany and during World War One and in the German Revolution. Otto Neurath went around to different workers' halls and to different governments and tried to convince them of needs for socializing, what he called socialization. We need plans for socializing our society, right? That means transforming property relations at all scales, so that we can consciously control the economy. He called that socialization, and he was put in charge of the Office of Economic Planning in Bavaria during the Bavarian Soviet Republic, which was run by basically anarchist poets for a couple of weeks before it was overthrown by a communist, Eugene Levine, and then it was overthrown by the White Army or not the the Freikorps. And Otto Neurath was arrested, but later let go because Max Weber pleaded for him in front of the court. But he called himself a scientific utopian, right? He says, we need utopias, we need visions, we need plans that can give us possibilities for the future based on real statistical knowledge of the present. So what are our needs today? What are our energy sources? What makes people happy, right? What are the criteria for happiness? Can we measure that or not? What would it mean to produce things according to that measure and not according to money? He was a very he was a non-monetary socialist. I think this kind of utopianism is always possible, right? The scientific utopianism, this kind of thinking through the details of another way of life without money, without the market, without the state even. And in our climate catastrophe, right, which is the decline of fossil industry, it's also the decline, you could say, of a way of capitalism. It's the decline of a kind of fossil capitalism. Not yet, but it's a long project, I would say. I'm not so optimistic that it's like a 5-year project. I think it's more like a 50 to 100 year project, unfortunately. Is it a decline of capitalism? That's too early to say. But there's a general decline of a way of life happening. And with this decline of fossil capitalism, you know, our subjectivity is also tied to this role of using cheap fossil products, cheap oil products to do things. So when that changes, we'll change too. That's the hypothesis, that we'll change too, and that things that were reified, alienated about us have the opportunity of being broken down, disintegrated, and transformed. That's the utopia. That in that image of the decline of this kind of fossil capitalism, the subjects who are basically like fossilized subjects, alienated subjects, also have an opening to relate to each other, relate to nature, relate to who we are differently, and to transform it.
The double meaning of fossilized, I think, is very, very profound, right? Because there's politics is fossilized, right? It's politics is still in the 20th century, but under 21st century conditions. You talk about eco-fascism and you talk about climate barbarism. Of course, climate Leviathan, climate behemoth as well. From what's the other book that's a reference from 2018?
Climate Leviathan.
Climate Leviathan. Yeah, thanks. But like, this is a huge opening for all sorts of forces of reaction, because it seems as though what's being imposed in like the defossilization, not just of the economy, but of like everyday life, is a choice being made on the part of various different elites. The idea that it's a conspiracy, I think, becomes less plausible every single day, but that only leads politically to like a stronger reaction, because it's a defense of an entire like capitalist individual mode of being, which is collective, that's being thrown up against the necessary, the increasingly obvious necessary. And so I think that you can't, of course, exclude from the equation these right-wing populisms. You can't exclude climate from that, because what this crisis does is it poses the death of an entire way of life. And that is the decline that you're talking about, right?
Yeah. And I think it's very rational for people to reject it at first. If they see, like it's rational for people to be anti-ecological if they think ecological transition is kind of, if they see it as a class project to offload responsibility on the individual, on them.
Right.
So if the government says, hey, you workers over there, you got to start paying more taxes for your cars. You have to, start, or you get punished. I mean, then why would they want to be part of a green or ecological transition if the responsibility is being offloaded onto them? On people who, live by a wage to survive, and the generation of carbon in the atmosphere was not caused by them.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, everyone has a part to play, but I think this, there's a very unequal distribution of responsibility. So the understanding that there is and there will be, I think, more and more of a reaction, resentment, like an ecological resentment about like building wind farms in our backyard, transforming our homes. I think it's going to be very real. You already saw it in the Gilets Jaunes. And I think it's just going to be more and more if it's not already thought about. How do you have a non-reactionary mode of a climate transition? I think it's such a, and this is what the deluge is also about. To think through.
Don't talk about the deluge. I don't want to hear what the future is going to look like. It sounds terrible. I don't want to be deluged. I want to live in my little bubble and not think about the deluge.
But Sean, I mean, you're already sort of acting on it in the sense by, working in these green transition type projects. And an interesting proposal of this piece is the transition from this asceticization of decline that turns us all into like despairing, powerless individuals, into trying to think about how we can continue the communist project as a project of repair, not of a project of living through the disaster, but actually fixing the world by, for example, putting carbon back into the earth, or pushing back against these horrific sounding geoengineering projects that'll block out the sun. You talk about that project as if it's something that could plausibly be enacted either in the industrial core or in the periphery, trying to deal with the externalities of the industrial core, and how that'll create the scenario where there will be inhabitable barbarous zones and uninhabitable barbarous zones, which is pretty grim look into the future. But I think that is sort of what the collective imagination of what society will look like, and is increasingly how society does look like. But yeah, maybe let's talk a little bit about what a communism of repair looks like.
Yeah, I think the idea of repair, or having a project of repair, repairing ecosystems, right? Or repairing our repairing energy sources, repairing technologies, repairing our relationships to each other. I think repair is just a good word for capturing all of this, right? Mm. It's also like an engineering project is repair. So you're repairing production. You're repairing kinds of production sites in a way that is somehow ecological, right? More ecological, more sustainable. And this is that's why I call it. It's also a project of labor. It's a reorganization of labor on a massive scale, in which I think. I mean, I just wonder right now to think about 70 years from now, if kind of ecological repair work is just part of our mode of being.
Mm.
It's not like a separate thing we do. It's just part of our everyday life, just like using cars is today. or using the subway, right? Like kind of incorporating a kind of reparative attitude to our natural conditions is kind of a core part of our daily activity. Doesn't seem separate from us as something we have to do, something that we're a part of, because we've reconfigured how we understand nature as this non-separate thing.
Yeah. That's interesting, because if you think in a hopeful way about the way under capitalist modernity our the vast majority of people, society's relationship to nature changed, you know, it's only with industrial capitalism that you start to have a conservation movement, right? It's only when nature becomes something external to us as opposed to a force that we grapple with day in, day out in like simple commodity production of agriculture or peasant life. When nature starts to become something external to ourselves is only 150 years ago, right? Nature as a separate entity. I guess part of the process of this would be to like reemerge in the process of repair, to also like reemerge ourselves with nature, but not in like an automatic or unthinking way, but instead as like a productive way, as like, you know, because I'm thinking you can respond to that. And then I had another point too about the green transition.
Well, my friend here, Daniela Rus, she writes about the Russian cosmism and this early Soviet Union projects of rethinking the communist human beings' relationship to the planetary energy, and visions of you know, using the oceans to create energy to go to Mars and reconceiving solar power to create solar communism. And already, like, you know, with the Bolshevik Revolution, with the German Revolution, this kind of visions of planetary redevelopment, were already there. And so that's why I also think repair doesn't necessarily have to be returning to an unbroken state. I think that would be a dangerous way of thinking.
Yeah.
Like you said, a transformative repair. So
like a sublation of our relationship.
You could call it that. You could call it an Aufhebung if you want.
We do.
Now, I think, because Andy mentioned it, geoengineering would be like a very big blockage on this process. It'd be very difficult to do this if we are confronted with a geoengineered planet in which now we have technological apparatus for maintaining a livable atmosphere.
And capitalism.
But with unintended consequences everywhere, and that it's debatable how it can be stopped at all.
Yeah, there's the danger of the termination shock, and there's also the danger too if you have these massive, say, sun blocking geoengineering plans, and there's still states and there's still capital, necessarily that's only going to increase the power of the ruling class, because it's going to be a tiny minority, similar to the tiny minority of people on Earth who control like the fate of the world with ICBMs and nuclear weapons. There'll be a tiny minority that has control over our ability to like continue living on the Earth by blocking out using technology to block the rays of the sun, or using aerosols, or even like seeding the seas in order to induce more carbon sink into them.
Yeah, I think geoengineering is very possible. It's very possible.
I see it as probable at this point.
It's hard to say, because it's just not that technically difficult to do on different scales.
Mr. Burns did it.
What's that?
Mr. Burns did it. Remember, he put that big sphere in the sky and blocked out the sun.
Exactly, he blocked out the sun.
There's a single nuclear plant owner can afford it. You know, in this world, it's possible.
I mean, so then you have to think about, the power of those people who control kind of the means of geoengineering, the means of geoengineering production. That's a very big power, just like the power of the bomb. It's a different power, though, right? Because now, if you stop it, it could cause a problem.
Right. It's not starting a nuclear war. It's stopping.
It's like now you can't stop the war, or else, you know.
A civilization. You have to have a civilization that includes the people who control that, unless that is like the power over that collective us.
It's just such a complicated moral conundrum, I think, that challenges our basic conceptions of how do you have a livable planet, an emancipatory planet, a vision of the future, once you have these kind of these questions arise. And I just think it's better to discuss them now.
Yeah, that's why your work was important enough that we brought you back on for like a fourth time, right? Because these questions have to be confronted now because the consequences are coming down the pipe.
Yeah.
You know, I think the way that things are going, and I keep coming back to my own personal experience, the way things are going with Biden's Inflation Reduction Act, like it's not actually the Green New Deal, right? But it's like using investment, spending money into different places, putting in regulations through the administrative state, providing basically like seed capital for all sorts of investments in climate change. The United States has been able to buy off my local. The state of New York has been able to buy off my local in terms of like subjective distaste or disdain for green energy. At least in all the dozens upon dozens of people in my local that I've talked to about it, it's not a thing, right? People accept that you can get paid union rate to do this work and they'll do it, just like they would accept union rate to build a prison or build a natural gas power plant, right? But the capacity of capital to buy off like those who create and recreate and maintain society day in and day out is possible in a place like the United States still for historically contingent reasons. For like economic power reasons, but it's not possible everywhere else. It's like increasingly not possible in places like Germany, right? Where the state and this is not just like a decline of a type of capital, like a period of capitalist development, but it's also a decline of states, not the state in the abstract sense, but like actual capitalist states are in the process of dissolution and decline. What you're going to have, of course, is like an uneven development of this next phase of electrification and transition that is going to be able to buy off some working classes. But of course, others are going to be left completely in the lurch. And this is part of the anti-planetary. Would you call that barbarism, or would you call that eco-fascism?
Yeah, I tend to think of climate barbarism as a kind of a more top-down state strategy for managing decline in a non-solidaristic way. And eco-fascism is a more kind of popular resentment toward by scapegoating others. And I think we want to avoid both of these, right? We want to manage the decline in a way that's, you know, maybe emancipatory. And so this is the question also of like, can this transition be democratized in a sense, right? Can it be done by workers taking over or having more worker power or more, you know, civil power, more social power? Can it be managed from below? That's kind of the question. There are all these projects and campaigns here in Germany for, you know, socializing energy, recommunalizing the grid, socializing housing, so directing this process in a more social way. But they get stopped at the kind of the federal and the international level because, you know, the interdependency of Germany on energy sources from outside of it. It's just very hard to do this in a national framework, right? When you're just so dependent on your energy sources from outside. Also, like, you know, Germany also has this, you know, crazy policy of the Schwarze Null, this kind of this no surplus basically, or no debt. Right.
Oh, right. Yeah. Ordo-liberal.
The Schwarze Null, you can't go over zero. So they're kind of shooting themselves in the foot by not wanting to invest in these things. So this also raises the question of, like what you said, can you take over the power of like investment, or who controls the power of investment? Can investment be socialized? What does that mean? I mean, there are people thinking about this in terms of democratizing finance, democratizing the ownership of capital. I think it's still in early phases of thinking about it. But what's interesting is that it's just being thought about on all kinds of scales, not just because it's like socialist or left, but because maybe it's just necessary.
Mm-hmm.
Like maybe it's just necessary that you need to have more people involved in directing production and reproduction on a general level, just for habitability, sustainability's sake. It just makes more sense than letting it up to the market alone. And I think this is an interesting parallel. I'll bring it back to the German Revolution. After World War I, this massive kind of catastrophe, this brutal destruction of life on a massive scale, people thought, oh, you know, maybe socialism is just more rational. You know, and you had like businessmen say this and government say this, and they're like, you know, this whole capitalism thing, it just led to just utter barbarism. Let's just try something else. It didn't really go that way, but that was in the air.
Yeah, you can read like Supreme Court judgments from like the 19-teens and 1920s and the good progressives like the Brandeises are like, this capitalist system way too chaotic. We have to bring in like other voices from the outside. We can't let this system continue the way that it's been going. And you kind of almost like our ruling class too has declined and degraded since 100 years ago too, right? Like there's when you're talking about this, these conceptions of socializing, there's like socializing things in a capitalist framework, and then there's like socializing things. Yes. We're getting like a quasi socialization now. We're getting like stakeholder socialization. Yep. Yep. Which is obviously insufficient, but I wonder if the one might lead to the other, or if like the power of capital, and I don't mean like capitalists, but capital itself, means that like the going from one type of socialization to another is going to take more than like people smoking cigars in back rooms somewhere in Brussels, probably.
I mean, this is what Marx alludes to in volume 3, right? When he's talking about he talks like sort of optimistically about the joint stock companies, and you know, it's, I think that's a bitter pill to swallow for our generation of leftists. But in a way, he's sort of saying, you know, the capitalist class is increasingly coordinating on this larger scale to handle the anarchy of the market, the externalities that the market produces if left to its own devices, and that these joint stock companies can sort of be taken over at some point. But then we're still sort of stuck in this cul-de-sac of like, well, if we take them over, are we still going to be trying to take them over in the, you know, in the sort of interests of a working class that's increasingly linked to increased profitability and increased expansion instead of repair?
I mean, this is exactly right. Like you pointed to this, I would say, ambiguity in Marx about like there's a germ of this of socialization in capital itself. Capitalism is its own kind of socialization through private property. Through the market, it socializes labor, and it does it more and more. And then ownership itself kind of gets socialized through these joint stock companies, and they have to be transformed. But they already show the way; they're already abolishing ownership on individual level, and they're socializing it. And Marx was writing, you know, a long time ago, and it was very early. He said, "Yeah, there's a germ of transition within capitalism that has to be kind of liberated." I think now we can see that didn't really happen that way, right? It didn't automatically lead to some kind of liberation of a socialized mode of production. But you could say, you know, that maybe that process also needs active transformation, right? So there's tendencies in society that can point beyond itself, and there's people, classes, and organizations that can fight to intervene, direct it. I mean, it's like Luxembourg debate, you know, Luxembourg versus Bernstein. Do you just let capitalism reform, or do you kind of intervene at key moments and try to act? And socialization is an interesting term because it means both, right? It means this passive process of the socialization of the means of production. It can also mean this active process of intervening and changing and reshaping ownership. It can be, like you said, Sean, it can be anti-democratic. Like it could be technocratic. Like you could have managers in a room who say, okay, we're going to do this. But you could also have kind of a bottom-up or a socialist socialization or democratic or communist one.
There's a third way in which we talk about socialization, which is the socialization of children, right? Like the raising and bringing into society of young people. And so like this background noise is more and more moving to the center. So there's always some hope, right, that like the blunt reality of a changing world, which we're living through right now, as Andy and I sit in a heat dome here in New York. Thank God I'm off work today because I'm going to D.C. later on. But like socialization also means like the process of becoming a human within society. So I wonder if like if that might be a key to kind of complicating and also refining conceptions of socialization.
I mean, this is, you know, now we're going to go to Hegel. I'm sorry.
Got to go to Hegel, man. We gotta, can't be a Jacob Blumenfeld Coleman situ episode if we don't go to Hegel.
You got to talk about, you know, Hegel and Geist and Bildung and the reshaping of human beings through Bildung, through education, through culture, through the development of spirit, right? Of this reshaping of our social being through knowledge and through activity. Yes, that makes us human, right? I would say we're not born human, we become human.
Mm.
But socialization and this level you're talking about, it could be also ambivalent. It can be an adaptation to capitalist norms, right? Mm. You're socialized into schools, into prisons, into politics. You're socialized to repress your nature, to renounce your pleasures. You know, this is what Freud talks about, you know, adapting to the reality principle. That's also socialization. So can there be a liberating socialization, like Marcuse talks about, releasing of eros, overcoming of the historically specific reality principle of capitalism and adapting to a new reality principle of socialism or communism? So yeah, that would be a socialization beyond society, I think, and not one that adapts to it.
Climate dungism seems to be the way things are going too in large swaths of the world, right? Amazing things are happening in China. I don't know if you guys have seen, but like their reforesting programs that they're doing, they're creating green belts in the desert. Of course, high speed rail. They're in the process right now in their developmentalist planning model where they are not only doing the transition, it seems quicker than quote unquote capitalist countries, but also like under the auspices of capitalist production, threatening the green transition in other nation states. And I'm thinking specifically about the electric car production and solar power production in China, the massive, you know, productive forces, which have created a quote unquote glut on the market of both photovoltaic, is that what they're called? Voltaic panels and also electric vehicles. There is a way in which the technology is necessary for some sort of process of like collective transition are coming online right now, but it's absolutely like the capitalist state, competing capitalist states, and also competing national capitals, which are stymieing this transition at the same time.
Yeah, like for example, Biden is working very hard to increase EV production in the United States while making sure that the far cheaper and far superior EVs from China don't make it here.
Right. For like $15,000, you can get a Chinese, you know, of course, easily like hyper exploited Chinese labor, blah, 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 blah. But for like $15,000, you can get a car, an EV far superior to a Tesla. But because of obviously national interests and capitalist interests here, you can't do it.
I mean, it's hard to talk about the future of the climate without talking about China. I mean, it's just such a big player. It's just, you know, 1.8 billion people becoming, you know, consumers, state-directed investment of green technology. Also, one of the biggest investments in fossil fuels. I mean, it's a very contradictory process. China has this massive renewable investments, massive reshaping of what's possible. Also, massive investment in coal plants at the same time.
Right.
I mean, it's just both, right? Because they need it over here to maintain energy sources at a cheap place, but they also want to be leaders in this other market. On a global level, so they're just doing both, and you know how China goes, the future will go on this, in to a certain extent, on this question. So it's really important to stay focused on and understanding what happens there, but also not only in terms of is China important in this transition, but also Latin America in terms of where the minerals and Africa in terms of where the minerals are that are powering this transition. Whether it's Chile or Bolivia or the DRC, I mean, looking at the world looking at capitalism as going through this kind of ecological or green transition can help you focus in on this kind of concrete logistical process of reshaping energy sources, creating new conflicts over land and labor, new conflicts over state power, and direct our attention to those struggles as like key struggles in the future, right? You know, what happens when people who live around lithium mines or people who live around copper mines say no, say fuck you,
right?
Or let's say they want to nationalize it. And they don't want it to power this green transition. You know, is China going to send in an army to force it?
Those are the ultimate roots always of economic imperialism.
Exactly. Is Shell going to go in there, or is whatever BP going to go in there? I mean, it's just a new war, right? It's a new scramble for green energy with new imperialist connotations. It's a new playing field that we're, I think, entering into now.
Yeah, and as always with these big geopolitical conflicts and wars, you know, we try not to root for one side or the other. We try to imagine a way that class power could be a way out of this, a way out of not just the conundrum of war and misery under a declining capitalist system, but also potentially the fruits of a new transition, a working class transition, a proletarian transition, grasping our human powers from above, storming heaven and bringing them down to earth. This is the dream. This is what we still dream. This is the sort of shit that me and Jacob and Andy were spouting off about 13 years ago, and we still are to this day. So I think that's about as good a place as any to leave it off. People strongly encouraged to read both of your pieces, Managing Decline and Climate Barbarism. I think you have another article on socialization coming out soon. Is that right?
I have one in German. Sorry.
Ah, damn.
It's already out on socialization and planning, but it should be some more stuff on English. But look in the next Brooklyn Rail for an article on Günther Anders.
Hell yeah. Good stuff.
Thank you.
Do you have like a minute left to help me work through this Horkheimer quote at the end?
Yeah, that's a hard one.
Let's bring up that Horkheimer.
I probably can't read it in its entirety, but it seems to be dealing with this question of subjectivity and the way progress is both this destructive process of uprooting people from their communities and from their identities. So he says that the general trend towards the dwindling of personal property, but other equally necessary conditions of being affected by the process of industrial development. People constantly move within cities or from one city to another. They no longer have a permanent home, and change has a differentiating effect on the individual. So, you know, great reset. And then at the end, he gets to this point that seems somewhat optimistic, if I'm reading it correctly, that in the atomized social reality, the atom is split as it is in the physical world, yet both dissolve something that had been mistakenly hypostasized. What is being destroyed through the process are mythical entities. It is justice that puts an end to them. What does that mean? The mythical entities, yeah. What is that? And what does he mean by justice?
Yeah, well, I love this like late Horkheimer quote. Horkheimer was the director of the Institute for Social Research, one of the founders of Frankfurt School of Critical Theory, who just had an interesting career of thinking. And this is from a book called Dawn and Decline, which contains his early kind of 20s, more revolutionary aphorisms, and then his late 50s and 60s ones, where he became a bit more conservative. So it's got both together, Dawn and Decline. And that's kind of, I took that as inspiration for my text, actually, this book. It's his version of Minimum Moralia. So here, I think what's interesting of this quote is he's saying, okay, modernity or our 20th century modern bourgeois society is so hyperactive, right? It's so it's so accelerated. We're moving around all the time. We're destroying old relationships all the time. The atom that we are, the self, is like pulling apart, right? Like, where's the stability in ourselves? It's pulling apart at the edges. We're kind of suffocating under this pressure of work and of basically of work, but of movement of the market. Of circulation. But then he says, okay, but what actually is being destroyed, right? What is this self that's being destroyed in this process? He says, this is a mythical entity, right? This bourgeois subject, this individual that thinks it's kind of a monad, self-contained and distinct from its relationships. It's being broken apart. And I think this is this, like, you know, this just about Marx, about the progressiveness of capitalism, kind of destroying traditional and patriarchy. Here it's about Horkheimer saying, yeah, this is destroying the bourgeois subject in a sense. And that can release new forms of subjectivity or new forms of social relations out of it. Like, so what's being destroyed is something that's already reified, right? Mm-hmm. Already kind of created to adapt to a wrong world. So I was thinking, is that, or can that also happen with this decline of fossil capitalism? can this kind of fossilized subject, which is, you know, being pushed out and being crushed, can there be something liberated from that destruction, right? Because that's hypostasized as well. That's a mythical entity.
And that what's would be the justice at the very end? Is the justice communism?
No, justice, it means like it's correct in a sense. I think that's the German translation. It's justice means it's correct that this mythical entity is being destroyed. Mm. It's like it's due to it. So our fossil capital way of life, it's justice that will bring an end to it in a sense.
Profound stuff, as always, man. I gotta read some Horkheimer, apparently. Make this critical theory thing stuff sound like something I should probably read. I don't know.
Next time
it is. Yeah. Well, thank you, human. Thank you, citizen.
Thank you. I love being part of your species being.
Thank you for species being here. So Cured Quail is still available for pre-order, right? Or is it what time do you what time will the first copies be sent out?
I'm not the editor, but I think they are still collecting money for pre-orders. They just print when they have enough money to print.
Okay.
So I think they're still trying to get enough money to print the next issue. But there's a lot of great essays in there about, there's one about techno music.
Oh, hell yeah.
One about conspiracism, about concrete, about obedience. So there's a lot of good essays that are kind of critical, you know, critical cultural theory and cultural critique, in the way that, you know, our friend
Eric John Russell.
He likes to do it.
He does it good.
Yeah. So go to curedquail.com and pre-order it, or buy a copy if it's out by the time the episode's out, hopefully.
Yeah. All right, guys.
Thank you.
Talk to you soon, man. Thank you so much.
All right, man. Mwah.